I've been asked to address the question of local economies in globalizing environments. When we start talking about the economy, there are two things that I want to put on the table. One is the amount of expertise in this room. I wouldn't dare to go into the details of the economies of New York and London. Collectively, it's a vast amount of knowledge. The other one is that any complex city has many economies. Not only that, these economies occupy very different territories. They extend into regions. For New Yorkers, they're getting used to it, but it's still New Jersey, that they do not relate to as being part of their city, and they go underground. So to extricate from this sort of complex map something that we might call the local economies, and to think about the policy implications that this might entail, and to do what I was asked to do, which is to think about the knowledge that we have for New York and London, and what that could mean, what kinds of analytic grids that might produce when we begin to deal with Shanghai and with Mexico and with the other cities that are part of the Urban Age project. So I'm going to stay a bit analytical. It's a bit my comfort zone anyhow. And in 15 minutes, and with Bruce Katz here policing, there is no way that I can give a full account. So let me suggest that what we're really seeing in these complex cities is three types of what approximates the notion of a local economy. One is a local-local economy, the way we used to understand the term. A second one is a local economy, but it is actually deeply and in multiple ways, not just in one way, articulated with a global economy. And then there is a third, and I would refer to that as a localized economy, and that is sort of the self-evidently global sector that we see in any of these cities. Let me start with the last one and then work my way back into the other local economies. The question that we need to ask ourselves, how much longer is this pattern of agglomeration among leading sectors in dense urban environments going to last? There are prices, there are costs that attach for firms and for markets to operate in these environments. And when you think of September 11, it was a very interesting experience, and I hope I don't offend anybody, but it was in a way a brutal event that put the question of inertia, the inertia that many of these firms have, right there on the table. Indeed, many firms did leave, but many came back. A whole lot came back. And some of them are building huge trading floors right down there in Lower Manhattan. In the case of London, there is more need for that kind of centralized, dense space. What is it that makes these firms and these markets want to operate in these very dense and high-cost and high-risk environments? And here I think we really need to go beyond the face-to-face. Because, I mean, one sort of, for me, critical proposition is that these firms are not about to factor in to their operations our human need to look at each other. They are barracudas, let's just put it on the table, right? I mean, that doesn't count. So we know that there is something about face-to-face. We know that there is some utility that these firms derive from these spatial agglomerations. And let me sort of throw out four elements that in a way mark, if you want, the logic for ongoing agglomeration in these cities. Two caveats. One, whatever can routinize, and we have 20 years of history with good data, whatever can routinize, routinizes and leaves. And this is going on all the time. Second, there seems to be a vortex of innovation and transformation at the heart of these sectors, with new sectors coming in that, if you want, keeps this operation of being centralized going. Now, four logics. First one, the technologies. The technologies have made us fall flat on our face. as forecasters, as predictions, etc. Why? Because I think that what has happened to a very large extent is that we have forgotten that a sector like finance uses the technology, but it is not about the technology. It has its own logic. So a first, if you want, thesis that I would like, and I would really like to consider it sort of a marking feature as to why this spatial agglomeration continues, is that the result of the use of these new technologies by firms and markets produces an outcome that is a hybrid. It's a mix of the logic, the capabilities of these technologies, and the logic of the users, which is going to be very different. If it's finance, it's of one sort, but it's not the technology. So what you get at the end is an outcome that contains a thwarting, if you want, of the technical capabilities. We cannot continue to assume that if technologies develop that allow for a certain kind of dispersal, that that's going to happen. And the case of finance, I think, is the best example. It has very high levels of global dispersal and system integration and enormously high levels of spatial concentration. Why? Because it is not about the technology. And I think this is something, I just give you the example of finance here, but this is something that we need to run across economic sectors. And I think in the 80s we saw a whole number of forecasts that simply went wrong. Second critical point, we as urbanists, when we think about the global economy, it is not a question of something that is out there. What brings it down to the space of the city is the work of running global operations of markets and of firms. We have to recover the work. The typical analysis is powerful multinational corporations, so we have a global economy. Powerful technologies, so we have a global economy. All of that is also true. But part of the issue is really to bring it down to the work of running these global operations. Once you begin to bring in the work of running these global operations, you have, at one end at least, a bunch of highly specialized, highly sort of speculative activities that need that grounding. Again, whatever can routinize will routinize and leave. Third issue, the meaning of information in an information economy. A lot of focus on access to information. By God, it's true. We can access information wherever we are. But information doesn't just grow on trees. Information is also made. And in these very advanced sectors, in the kinds of cities that we're focusing on, the making of information is a whole industry unto itself, yes, but also, and this is the critical point I really want to bring to the table, is that it needs to be, if you want, incorporated into the work process of these kinds of sectors. Now, when you put all of these things together, what you get is a bunch of conditionings, of constraints on these globalized actors that produces the need and certain kinds of advantages, utilities for these sectors to operate in these cities. So we have, I think, something that is going to be here for a while, no matter the new technologies that are invented. And I think that we need to factor that in, because this localizing of this kind of economy is not an innocent event. It carries enormous consequences for the larger space of the city. And we have to factor that into. Now, second point, very quickly. The local economy that is linked to this global sector. And here I just very quickly, I want to just put on the table things that we don't think about. First point, and this is something that I really care about a lot, and when I used to be in New York, I actually spent quite a bit of time on that, and also in London, and that is something that we could call urban manufacturing. And what I'm trying to get at here is a kind of work, a kind of local economy that we do not associate with the issue of globalized cities, global cities, where we think of other kinds of sectors. Now, second point, it contains an inversion of the historical relationship between manufacturing and services. The historic relation is that services are servicing manufacturing. This is an inversion. This is a manufacturing sector that is servicing service industries. What are we talking about? All kinds of making of wood and metal products for real estate development, for architects, for designers, etc., etc. There is also the garment vis-à-vis fashion. But there is a world of little shops. And when we were working on this in New York, we made a census with a whole bunch of very nice urban planning students at Columbia University. That's where urban planning students are very, very good. And we actually counted the number of these shops in Manhattan. They were an invisible presence in the city. There were shop manufacturing shops that we had never realized that they were there. So you have a lot of this that is also part of these enormously sort of globalized and, you know, and very advanced economies that we're dealing with. And that needs to be brought in. Second little point, again, something that is usually not brought into the picture. I think that one of the, I like to think of it as a capability that is an infrastructure for these new leading economic sectors is the professional household. Bear with me, okay? I know that this comes as a surprise, this term, but there is a kind of professional household where you have two dedicated, or one dedicated professional. The professional household is a household without a wife, no matter that. Richard and I, my husband and I, we are one of those professional households. We need a wife, and I'm sure that you recognize the pattern. Now, demographers have talked about this. You know, no, it is actually a very particular capability. And here comes also something about the role that women have played in the process of urban gentrification in these cities. Now, what I want to bring into the picture is two things. One is, this is a kind of household, a dedicated professional who loves the work, who's willing to work for 80 hours, who delivers the best, who does not have time for anything else, barely for the partner. The global care chains, I don't know if that term is familiar to people. There's a whole infrastructure of low-wage workers that are part of the possibility of having this professional household. And these global care chains, nannies and cleaners, and I don't know what all, you know, it varies, it depends how fancy that household is. But this is also part of the global city economy, and I just want to make sure that we include that. Now, there are a whole set of variants, and when I think of work that is being done in cities, we have quite a bit of interesting research that documents, for instance, an international real estate market that runs through immigrant communities, that is part of a city like New York, etc., etc. So a whole bunch of issues that are a kind of local economy linked to the globalized sector. Secondly, a local economy that we do not recognize easily as being linked to the globalized sector, and that we easily think of as being sort of, something that doesn't belong anymore in these. They are part of the new global economy. They are part of advanced capitalist economies, and I think we sort of need to bring that into the picture. Final point. These kinds of cities are Silicon Valleys for creativity and innovation. Jane Jacobs gave us sort of a wonderful analysis of that many years ago. And the issue of the new sectors that get created is a big one, I think, when we're thinking about economies. We tend to think of it in terms of new sectors that are truly advanced, software development. For instance, both in London and in New York, software development linked to finance was the first form that software development took, and then it became new media. You had a surplus of software designers, it became new media artists, new media, etc., etc. But there are also such sectors as private prisons. And so if New York doesn't have enough prisoners to put in the private prisons, because private prisons, you're running a motel, you need to fill those beds, you know, it's a business. These are also entering. And again, what I'm trying to do is to sort of unsettle the notion of what these advanced economies really represent as economies. They are many economies, they are many spaces, there are many different types of international circuits, not just finance, also immigrant issues. Those are the most familiar ones. There are a variety of other ones. So that when we think about policy, when we think about comparing different cities, when we think about what can we learn from New York and from London, for instance, and then take it to Shanghai, though I would do that with enormous care, I think it gets very messy. And the key issue is that I do think that while none of this is totally new, the thresholds we are crossing in some of the figures that Tony Travers showed, for instance, do make it a novel condition. And it's going to take some very innovative thinking around policy issues. I have not mentioned, but I will just, I have not discussed, but I want to invoke it, the question of new kinds of inequalities and new types of segmentations. New York is a machine for producing wealth. New York is one of the cities that has the highest level of officially counted poor. And our definition of official poverty is a very stingy one. And London is doing very well on these two fronts, too. A machine for